Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is October 15th. Any questions?
Does anybody else have any problems viewing your PowerPoint presentations online?
Downloading the PowerPoints, or?
Yeah, like to print them.
Yeah,
because like chapter 11 doesn't even show up.
Chapter 11 PowerPoints aren't showing up?
At least for you.
So does anybody have that same problem? You got it? Huh? It's not coming up at home. You have problems with 11. Home at work on 11. Maybe I'll try to re-upload them or something. Or see. It sounds pretty freaky. I don't know. I'll try to take a look at it and see. Every single page. Oh, that's too bad, because then you couldn't go to black and white then, probably. You had to print it in color if it was a color printer. Good thing you did at work. Okay, I'll try to take a look at those. Okay. Yes. Yeah, let me say something about the next test. So it is scheduled for October 29th. That is a Thursday, and I think we're going to have it on the 29th. All right, but it's going to include autonomic nervous system, which is chapter 9. It's going to include sensory chapter, which is 10, and endocrinology, which is 11. So 9, 10, and 11 on the 29th. But please attend lectures to find out if we keep the test on that date or not, okay? But that's the plan right at the moment. Okay. All right, so let's finish up something about the what we're talking about with the senses chapter. And I'm going to move this over here. Okay. All right, so we still got to talk about vision, static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium, and hearing. So we got four special senses left. All right, so make sure you know the difference between a general sense and a special sense. And if you were going to say, what's the difference between a general and a special sense? Yeah, general sense has receptors all over the body. They're ubiquitous. Every place has them. Special senses, on the other hand, only have one or two receptors. And they're usually organized into very complex receptor organs, like eyes or ears and things like that. All right, so let's look at some of those special receptor organs for equilibrium. And there are two kinds of equilibrium, but they all kind of work the same way. And equilibrium originates from the inner part of your ear that we call the vestibular apparatus. So you might remember this from anatomy. Vestibular apparatus, all right, includes the macula here, as well as the semicircular canals, but does not include the cochlea. The cochlea is a bony labyrinth for hearing. Okay. All right, so the sense of equilibrium is due to the ability of the inner ear, namely the vestibular apparatus, to monitor acceleration. So that's change in body position. And one of the funny things about gravity is that it actually acts like acceleration. It acts like linear acceleration. It's pulling you in one direction. All right, so which way is it pulling you? Down into the center of the earth, right? So it acts like acceleration. That's what we call static equilibrium. The sense of being able to perceive gravity is static equilibrium. And the other kind of equilibrium is what we call dynamic or kinetic equilibrium, and it's not linear acceleration, it's an angular acceleration. So when you start to spin, that's when the other part of the vestibular apparatus, namely the semicircular canals, become involved. All right, so these are both part of the inner ear. The vestibular apparatus consists of otolith organs, right, which we call the utricle and saccule, as well as the semicircular canal. So there are five organs that will monitor these senses. So here we see the utricle, and here we see the saccule, and inside the utricle and saccule, there are organs that we call the maculae, and we're going to take a look at those. And inside the semicircular canals, in these bulges right here and right here, They kind of look like little vials. So somebody once upon a time called them the ampulla of the semicircular canals because they look like a tiny little ampule, right? An ampule is a tiny, tiny little bottle that is holding something. The crista ampullaris are in each of these ampulla, and that's responsible for kinetic equilibrium. Okay, the sensory structures are located within the membranous labyrinth, right? And these labyrinths are filled with endolymph. And the membranous labyrinth is encased inside of a bony labyrinth. All right, so again, we can see the membranous labyrinth is making up the maculae here inside the saccule and utricle, and the membranous labyrinth inside these ampulla right here are made up of the crista ampullaris. And even the cochlea has fluid inside of it running through the membranous labyrinth. All right, and we'll talk about that last in terms of the ear. Okay, so the utricle and saccule provide information about linear acceleration. So you can accelerate yourself linearly, not just by sitting in the gravitational field, but for instance, maybe if you're in a car and you hit the accelerator, right? And when you hit the accelerator really fast, what happens to your body with respect to the seat in that car? Yeah, you're jerked backwards, right? And your back is pressed up against the backrest of the chair, all right? So, and when you stop, what happens to you? Right, you lean forward, all right? So gravity is actually producing the same kind of effect, all right? With the semicircular canals right here, they're not sensitive to linear acceleration, for instance, when you accelerate or decelerate in a car, but when you start to spin or when you stop spinning. Not when you're spinning at a constant rate, right? But when you either begin or stop, then the crista ampullarii inside these ampulla right here give information to the brain. So let's look and see how the mechanisms for all three of these processes actually come about, right? And this is important for hearing as well. So the receptor cells for static equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium, and even hearing are due to cells that we call hair cells. And hair cells are the receptor cells. They generate receptor potentials. And they don't produce hair like what you have on your head, but here is a hair cell. And coming off the apical surface of hair cells, they have these cilia, these projections coming off of them. We call these stereocilia. And they can bend, right, when gravity acts on them or when they're accelerated. Right, so here we see a series of stereocilia, and they're all connected to a modified stereocilia that we call the kinocilium. And the kinocilium has special channels, ion channels in it, that can open or close depending on how it's bent. So for instance, if this kinocilium is bent away from the stereocilia, right, the membrane right here is depressed, and look what happens to the rate of action potentials, right, in the vestibulocochlear nerve. The rate of action potentials is very, very high, right? So how do you stimulate a nerve into creating all of these action potentials? Just think of an action potential. What initiates an action potential? Depolarization. And how would you typically explain depolarization? Sodium entering the cell, right? So when this kinocilium is bent away from the stereocilia, that opens up sodium channels, and sodium enters the cell, depolarizing the cell, and that, right, increases the rate of action potentials going to the brain. And when the kinocilium is bent toward the stereocilia, look what happens. Look at the rate of action potentials reaching the brain. It's inhibited, right? So how would you explain how this nerve is being inhibited by motion of this kinocilium right here? You could say, well, the sodium channels now are closing, all right? Or maybe you could say the potassium channels are opening up, right? So depending on how this kinocilium is bent, right, then you have a high rate of action potential is reaching the brain or a low rate. And so that is just then translated into a positional sense or a rotational sense inside your inner ear. Okay. All right, so let's think of the organs for a static equilibrium, which are the maculae, and there are two of them. They're given different names, the utricle and saccule, but they're both maculae, right? And so they're inside that vestibular apparatus. There is a basement membrane, and here we see some hair cells, and the hair cells have their stereocilia and kinocilium poking up into this gelatinous mass right here. So there is a viscous mass that the stereocilia are embedded in. And then on top of the gelatinous mass, there are crystals of calcium carbonate, and we call these otoliths. And these act as little weights. And you know, what does gravity do to a weight? It pulls on it, right? Okay. So when you're in anatomic position with your head erect, then these otoliths are pressing straight down on the stereocilia and they're not bending. But as soon as you tilt your head forward, guess what happens to these otoliths and this gelatinous mass right here? The otoliths are pulled down toward your feet. That bends the gelatin and it deforms the stereocilia, and that changes the rate of action potentials reaching the brain as a result. So in both of your ears, you have these otoliths, which are little crystals that are used for a sense of linear acceleration. All right, so even though this person isn't moving, gravity acts like acceleration. All right, and for instance, if this person with their head erect were in a car that all of a sudden started to accelerate, what would happen to these stereocilia right here? They would bend as well, and then you would get the sense of change in velocity, and then the cerebellum would take that into account so that you can maintain your balance. All right, so this positional sense is very important. Okay. All right, so both the utricle and saccule work in this way. They both have hair cells. They both have these otoliths. All right, the utricle is sensitive to horizontal acceleration, and the saccule is sensitive to vertical acceleration. So both of these are working at the same time. All right, let's go to kinetic equilibrium. Kinetic equilibrium is due to the semicircular canals and the organs inside the semicircular canals. All right, so how many planes do you need to describe space? Or how many different numbers would you have to tell me to find that cell phone right there on the table? Okay, three, right? You'd have to tell me in terms of the room how far right or left it is. All right, so I could line up with the phone, but am I able to pick up the phone? No, because that's only one other dimension. All right, what else would you have to tell me? How far front and back? All right, that's another one. But like, if I was on the ceiling, I still couldn't reach the phone. What else would you have to tell me besides right and left, front and back? You'd have to tell me how high off the floor it is, right? So in those three dimensions, then you could tell me exactly where that phone is. All right, so there are three dimensions in space, and you can spin in each of those three dimensions. You can spin right and left, right? Head over heels would be two of them. What would be another way you could spin? Okay, right and left, head over heels. There's another way that you can spin. I'm not picturing it at the moment. It will come to me. But there are three planes in which you can spin in, okay? And so we have three semicircular canals that can experience that spin. And inside these semicircular canals, there is endolymph. Okay. And all matter has a property of inertia. And here I'm going to have to rely on some people that have a background in physics. Maybe somebody does. What does inertia mean? Does inertia mean anything to anybody? Okay. It's a property of matter, and it just says that when you have mass and it's stationary, it doesn't want to move. It wants to remain stationary. That's one property. The other property of mass when it comes to inertia is once you get matter moving, once you have matter that has a certain velocity, then it likes to stay at that velocity. It doesn't want to stop. So those are the two properties of inertia. One is that if there's matter, it doesn't like to get moving, but once it does get moving, it doesn't want to stop. All right, so that's a pretty good example. And, you know, Thanksgiving is coming up pretty soon, and you might have a bunch of family over to your house, and you could demonstrate inertia, and it'd be really fun for you to do this, right? So, let's see. I have a water bottle right here, and we've got, what, mass in this water bottle. So we got a lot of water in this water bottle, so there's mass, and it has properties of inertia, which means what? That when it's stationary, when you try to push on it, it doesn't want to move. It wants to stay stationary. So what could you do during Thanksgiving time? You could set the table at home, right? Put the candlesticks on there, wine glasses, fill them up, and all the silverware and plates and things like that, and then grab the tablecloth and do what? Pull it out from underneath the table, and nothing's going to spill because all those wine glasses have inertia. They don't want to spill, right? So just like that. So I demonstrate inertia. So this fluid you could think of in terms of the ear as being endolymph. When you start to spin, what does this endolymph like to do that's in your ears? It likes to stay stationary, right, because it has inertia. And there is a special organ, namely the crista ampullaris, that can monitor the movement of that fluid inside your ears. So here we have the crista ampullaris, in these ampules, and this is what it looks like. All right, there's a little bulge right here. This gelatinous mass is what we call the cupula. It does not have otolith organs like the maculae do, the utricle and saccule, but nonetheless, there are hair cells in this epithelium right here, and the hair cells have the stereocilia and kinocilia poking up into the gelatinous mass, and surrounding everything is endolymph, right? Endolymph inside the semicircular canals. So when you're not accelerating in a spinning kind of motion, the endolymph is stationary, and so is the cupula, right? The crista ampullaris is stationary. So these stereocilia right here are not being bent. Now what happens if you start to spin in a direction? Well, the crista ampullaris is attached to your head, so as soon as you start spinning, the crista ampullaris starts to spin because it's attached to your head. But what about the endolymph? Because it has inertia, it doesn't start to move with your head. So that means then that the crista ampullaris is going to be pushed by the endolymph. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll talk about that after I get done with this. Okay. You can simulate vertigo, and sometimes it happens by itself. Okay, vertigo is a loss of balance when you see a spinning. Okay, yeah, I'll talk about that after I do the very basic kind of physiology here. Okay, all right. So when you start to spin, okay, the crista ampullaris is moving, but the fluid isn't. So the fluid actually pushes up against this gelatinous mass, and when it pushes up against this mass, right, then it deforms the stereocilia and kinocilia, and it changes the rate of action potentials going to the brain. All right, so you get the sense that you're starting to spin. And then when you spin for a really long period of time, what happens to the endolymph? It catches up to the spinning of your head, right, so it's moving at the same angular velocity, and when that happens, then of course this gelatinous mass just starts poking back straight up again, and the stereocilia then go back to their normal rate of firing action potentials, which it would be like when you're just standing perfectly still. Okay, so now you're spinning and spinning and spinning, and hold that thought. Because that endolymph has inertia, once you get mass into motion, what is it like to do? Stay in motion, right? So we can do that. Let's do that experiment. So the water in this bottle is endolymph. And let me put it over here, and let's get it in motion. So I have to start out slowly, get it in motion, and then I'll stop abruptly, and what should happen to the water bottle? It should fall over, right? Because that's the plan. All right, so we move it like that. Oops, did a little too fast. All right, we get it moving like that, and then stop. Oh, then it fell over really easy. Right, so when you spin for a long period of time, the endolymph is moving, and then you stop. The endolymph keeps spinning, and what does it do to those stereocilia? bends them back the opposite way. So now that changes the rate of action potentials reaching the brain, and you get, even though you're standing still, right, you get that sense of vertigo because your inner ear is telling you that you've stopped spinning. So that's what vertigo is all about. And that can be caused by a change in angular velocity, and it could probably be affected by chemical imbalance within the inner ear, electrolyte imbalance, and it could probably be due to a number of drugs. And of course, I've never experienced this, but for instance, when you're intoxicated with alcohol, things can spin because the nerves, right, are chemically damaged as a result of that for that period of time. Yeah.
What initially causes the cupula to move?
The cupula to move? The endolymph inside the semicircular canals. Because the semicircular canals are circular, right, fluid can actually flow in a circle all the way around the semicircular canals. And so, but it's not linear acceleration. You actually have to be twisting. You have to be in a circular motion in order to get that fluid to start flowing. All right? And remember, when your head starts to move, the endolymph is stationary, and the fluid doesn't want to move. And if something is moving with respect to the fluid, it's going to push the crista ampullaris one way or the other. And then when you stop spinning, right, the fluid is still going to want to move, so it's going to push on the stereocilia the opposite way. Because there are these sodium channels that can open and close when the kinocilium is bent. All right, so I'll put a little table on the board after we get done talking about hearing a little bit. All right, so don't forget, what is the hair cell is the receptor cell for angular acceleration. What's the receptor cell for linear acceleration? It's a hair cell as well, all right? But it's just incorporated into a little bit different organ. The utricle and saccule have these otoliths that respond to gravity and acceleration, linear acceleration. All right, but inside the semicircular canals, you have the crista ampullaris that responds to angular acceleration, not linear acceleration. All right, so what about hearing? The ears and hearing. So hearing doesn't really have much to do about change in velocity, whether it's a linear velocity or an angular velocity. It responds to a mechanical pressure wave that's moving through the air, and that's what we call sound. So sound waves travel in all directions from the source, right? So as I'm speaking, sound is radiating out through the whole room, and it travels like a wave, sort of like what you see on the ocean. So waves can be characterized by the frequency, and the frequency we talk about in terms of cycles per second, and that's what we call hertz. And it also is characterized by intensity. So I could draw a wave on the board, right? Or we could do, just draw a nice wave on the board like this. All right, so the intensity would be from this midpoint up to the peak of the wave. And as the sound gets louder and louder and louder, then the point from wave peak to wave peak stays the same. But what happens? The amplitude gets higher. All right, so the sound sounds louder as a result. So that's intensity measured by the amplitude of the wave. The frequency just means within a certain period of time, if we want to draw a wave at twice the frequency, what would we have to do? All right, so this would be now twice the frequency. It would be a higher frequency. So we can hear changes of intensity, we can hear changes of frequency, right? And this is a mechanical wave. And who's ever had an appreciation of this mechanical wave that we call sound? Probably everybody. What's a good example of actually perceiving it as a wave, as something that's vibrating? And I know each and every one of you, probably on the way to work this morning, was listening to KROQ, really loud, and you looked out the rearview mirror, and what was the rearview mirror doing? It was moving so fast, you probably couldn't even see any traffic behind you, right? Because your car was vibrating, right? So sound really is a vibration, a pressure wave moving through the air. And as you turn your radio down in intensity, what happens to the mirror, the vibration of the mirror? It goes away as well, right? And as you turn the intensity up, then the mirror vibrates even more and more and more. Okay. So that's frequency and intensity. Intensity is measured in decibels. Maybe sometime in lab we can actually measure our hearing. We do have an audiometer upstairs to do that. All right, so from anatomy, remember the anatomy of the ear. We have the external ear, right, which has the auricle or the pinna and the external auditory meatus. And at the end of this external auditory meatus, there is the tympanic membrane. And the job of the tympanic membrane is to do what? Just like your car mirror. It vibrates back and forth, right? And hopefully not too much because that could damage part of your ear, right? And when the tympanic membrane vibrates back and forth, then it vibrates the auditory ossicles inside the middle ear. They vibrate back and forth. There shouldn't be any fluid or anything in the middle ear unless you have an infection that we call that otitis media. So these bones, the malleus, incus, and stapes, we call the auditory ossicles, then transmit the vibrations in the tympanic membrane, okay, into the vibrations in the oval window. So the stapes is attached to the oval window, and you can see what, it has a nice oval footprint right here. Now you have fluid inside this bony labyrinth, and anybody remember the name of that fluid? Right here, that's endolymph, right? So that's endolymph in this fluid. So the pressure vibrations are transduced from an air medium into a watery medium. And the job of the tympanic membrane, you see the surface area is very large compared to the surface area of the oval window, plus the arrangement of these auditory ossicles, right, helps transfer sound from air into this watery environment. And that's kind of a difficult job to do. Have you ever been swimming and maybe talked to somebody that was on the pool deck? Right, you could talk to them as long as your head's above water, but as soon as your head goes below water, can you hear what they're telling you? No, so it's very difficult to get sound from air into water. It just doesn't, there's an impedance mismatch right there. The properties just don't match up very well. So this middle part of the ear acts as an amplifier and a way to match so that that energy can go from the air into that watery environment. All right, and it's, if you have fluid in the middle ear right here, then these auditory ossicles can't vibrate and it diminishes your hearing. All right, so now we have pressure waves inside the fluid of your inner ear, and then they travel through the cochlea right here, which looks like a snail. That's the bony labyrinth for hearing. All right, so why does it look like a snail, do you think? Why does it look like a snail? Because if you have a big object and you want to put it in a small space, what do you have to do? You have to fold it up or roll it up or whatever, and that's why the surface of the brain has convolutions in it, for instance. Okay, and this is just a way to get this receptor organ for hearing inside of a small space. But it could work just fine if it was unrolled, for instance. Okay. And what it's really like is like a piano. Okay. And if you unroll that cochlea, all right, if you unroll the cochlea, so it's all rolled up, but if you unroll it, it's just a flat, straight structure like that. And the reason why it's a piano, because this part of the membranes inside the cochlea respond to high frequencies, right? High rate of vibrations. And over here respond to low frequencies. So when this membrane vibrates, you're going to hear a low frequency. When this membrane over here vibrates, then you're going to hear a high frequency. And what are you going to hear in the middle? Like mid-range tones. Like people's voices and things like that. Okay. And what can you tell me about a piano? Why does a piano work that way? If you look inside of a piano, what does a piano have? It's got strings, right? But are the strings all the same shape and length? No, the high frequencies are what? Really short and thin. The low frequencies are what? Really long and thick. Well, the organ responsible for hearing, which is what we call the organ of Corti, has a similar kind of shape. All right, it's very, very thin at this region, and it's very, very thick down by this region. So the membrane down over here is very, very wide. And can anybody remember from anatomy what this part of the cochlea is called? The helicotrema. That's the end of it, right? That's the thickest part. So only low frequencies will vibrate the thick part of the organ of Corti, and only high frequencies will vibrate the very thin parts of it, right? And mid-range frequencies will vibrate the middle part of it. And strangely enough, guess what the name of that receptor cell is inside the cochlea making up the organ of Corti? Oh, look what I have right here. This is really nice. I didn't realize I had this. These are from your book. Okay. So here we have the cochlea, and what did we do to it? We just unrolled it, right? So here's the helicotrema, and we have the three different components of the ear, the scala vestibuli, which is connected to the oval window, and then down over here we have the scala tympani, which is connected to the round window, and then right smack in the middle, right here, this is what we call the cochlear duct. And the cochlear duct has the organ of Corti in it. So high frequencies, right, will go from the scala vestibuli across the cochlear duct into the scala tympani, right here very close to the oval window. But if they're low frequencies, they have to penetrate the cochlea farther and farther and farther, right, into near the helicotrema before they cross over the cochlear duct, vibrating that cochlear duct. So you should see this is the organ of Corti, and it kind of is laid out like a piano. One end responds to high frequencies, and the other end responds to low frequencies. Okay. Well, if we look at the organ of Corti, right here we see the scala vestibuli up over here and the scala tympani down over here. Oh, one last thing I want to say. Why do we have a round window right here? Well, if we inject a lot of energy, sound energy, into the cochlea via the oval window, and if it has no place to go, well, it's going to destroy the cochlea, right? So that energy comes in, and the round window allows it to escape, so the round window can vibrate back and forth, right? So that's why we have the round window right there, to allow that energy to escape without damaging this tissue, right? But even very, very loud noises will damage the cochlea because the round window isn't efficient enough to let that very, very loud noise out of your ear. All right, so here's the scala vestibuli, right? And on this diagram, here's the scala vestibuli. Here's the cochlear duct. And let's just say that at this particular region of the cochlea, sound is going to move from the scala vestibuli into the scala tympani right here just because the size is proper, right? This is going to match up with the frequency of the sound coming in. All right, so when sound moves across the cochlear duct, guess what's going to happen to this tectorial membrane? It's going to vibrate up and down. And let's see what is connected to this tectorial membrane. So let's really zoom in. Here we have some hair cells. And the hair cells project up into this tectorial membrane. And so when sound is vibrating the tectorial membrane, these receptor cells initiate action potentials on the cochlear nerve, and then you hear a particular sound. All right, so again, the name of the cell, the receptor cells, are hair cells. The same for static equilibrium, and it's the same for kinetic equilibrium. All right, so going back to this slide right here, all right, so the nerves that originating from the helicotrema go to a particular location in the auditory cortex, which is in your temporal lobe, and when those receive action potentials, you perceive a low frequency sound. And in a different part of the cortex of the temporal lobe, they're connected to the neurons from this region right here. When they receive action potentials, you hear a high frequency sound. So not only do you have something like a piano inside your ear, in your temporal lobes, you actually have something that's arranged just like a piano as well. So you have like two pianos in your temporal lobes. And when it gets stimulated with that right key, then you hear that particular kind of tone. Okay, so that's kind of interesting to think of it that way. But if you want to think of a harpsichord, that would work too. That would work just fine. Okay. I don't think we're so interested in the neuroanatomy of the pathway for hearing. Okay. But maybe from anatomy, you can remember that the inferior colliculus is important for auditory reflexes. Right? So between the second and third order neurons, we see that there is a nucleus right here, and the inferior colliculus is important for you to localize sound. All right, so when you hear sound, you know what direction it's coming from. So as a matter of fact, we could do a little experiment, I suppose. We've got four doors, but I can only really get to two of them quickly. All right, but I tell you what, we'll do a simpler experiment. The inferior colliculus will be able to tell you which one of these four doors is opening. Right? So I could have you close your eyes, I could open and close the door, and you could tell me which door is opening and closing. But we could do maybe a simpler experiment. I could have you close your eyes, and you could just tell me what part of the room I'm going to be lecturing from. Okay, so go ahead, close your eyes, I'll move, and you tell me where I am in the room. Okay, close your eyes. Okay, without opening your eyes, where am I lecturing from? Right smack in the middle of the room, right? All right, so you can open your eyes, and then if I move over way over to the left, you can hear me over here, right? And as a matter of fact, you could probably hear me walk around because the floor was creaking. All right, so what part of your brain is actually allowing you to perceive that information? That's the inferior colliculus that is doing that for you, right? Yeah. That's right. You need to have two functioning ears, because the reason why the inferior colliculus can figure that out is because sound takes time to move from one place to another. So if sound is coming from my right, guess what ear hears it first? My right ear hears it first, my left ear hears it second, and based on the difference in time, the inferior colliculus can tell where it's coming from. And if it arrives at both ears at the same time, then what? It's right kind of on a midline. All right, so it's either right in front of you or right behind you. And then your ear is actually so sophisticated, you can actually hear echoes from different parts of the room to figure out where is it coming from. Is it from in front of you or behind you, even though it's right on midline? Yeah.
How are echoes formed?
Well, sound is a mechanical wave. Okay, light is an electromagnetic wave, but sound is a mechanical wave. It's a real physical wave, kind of like, you know, this marker right here. So if I were to throw this marker up against the wall, guess what would happen to it? It would bounce off. So sound actually bounces off of objects too. So sound can bounce off the walls unless it's being absorbed. Like, for instance, we have carpet on the wall over here that will help absorb some of that sound so it's not so echoey. But if it's a hard surface, sound will bounce right off of it and will bounce around the room. So maybe have you heard an echo repeat itself maybe three or four times? Okay, like if you're outside someplace and there's a canyon, you can yell and you can hear it echo off of, bounce off of one wall of the canyon and then off of another wall and maybe even after a third. I don't know how many echoes I've heard at one time, but maybe three probably, something like that. Okay. So it can bounce off of structures. All right, so here we see the primary auditory cortex in the temporal lobe. So if we were to stimulate this area here, do I have, I'm just making this up because I don't know which one is the high frequency area, which one is the low frequency. But let's just say if this is the low frequency right here, right, then this region of the cortex would depolarize when high frequencies came into the brain. So again, this area is laid out just like a piano. Okay, and right in the middle, then mid-range frequencies. but would be appreciated if you were to stimulate that part of the cortex. All right, so I do want to put a little table on the board for you. All right, so we just got done talking about the ear and the three senses. What were the three senses? Static, equilibrium, I'll abbreviate it. All right, and then kinetic, equilibrium. All right, and kinetic sometimes is called dynamic. So static equilibrium is for linear acceleration. Kinetic equilibrium is for spinning or angular acceleration. I'll abbreviate that too. So here's one, here's two, and then what's the third sense did we talk about? Hearing. Okay, so the first we have outer ear, middle ear, inner ear. The outer ear is important for which one of these senses? All of them? It's really only hearing, right? So only this one, only for hearing. The outer ear is important only for hearing. Has no impact on equilibrium whatsoever. All right. What about the middle ear? What is that important for? And because of those auditory ossicles, for sure hearing, all right, but none of the other senses. Equilibrium, you could have a completely plugged up middle ear, and as long as it isn't affecting the inner ear, you'll have really good balance. Okay. And the inner ear then is important for all three, all right, just like that. All right, so what are the other parts? We've got the bony labyrinth. Oh, wow, I'm going to run out of room. Bony labyrinth. All right, the bony labyrinth for hearing, let's start down over here. The bony labyrinth for hearing is called the cochlea. How would you describe the cochlea? Kind of looks like a snail, right? It's all curled up. Can you see that? Yeah? Is that dark enough to see? Did I misspell it? Cochlea? No, that looks okay. Are you having a hard time with my writing? No? Okay. Cochlea. The bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium. What are those hoop-like things in your semicircular canals? The semicircular canals, and for static equilibrium, it's what we call the vestibule. All right, the next thing I want you to know is the organ responsible for these three senses. So in the vestibule, what's the organ? It has the otoliths on it, utricle and saccule, and those utricle, saccule, all right, both of these right here are what we call maculae. Both of those are maculae. You got two. One's a utricle, the other's the saccule. They have the same kind of arrangement, all right, and in the semicircular canals, what's the organ? For angular acceleration. That's the crista ampullaris. The crista ampullaris. And in the cochlea, what's the organ for hearing? Organ of Corti. All right, so you should probably have a picture in your mind of what those different organs look like. All right, some have crystals, some have that flappy tectorial membrane, some have just a gelatinous mass, the cupula attached to them. All right, now what about the receptor cell? The receptor cells for these senses. And does hearing seem to be a lot different sense than equilibrium? Yeah, it's a lot different in your everyday perception. So what kind of cells are responsible for static equilibrium? Are you kidding me? No, it's a hair cell. Exactly right. Tried to trick you. It's a hair cell. All right, what about for kinetic equilibrium? It's the same kind of cell, but a little bit different arrangement in the organ. And what about for hearing? Hair cell. Okay. So this could be used to also used as evidence for what kind of process? Could be used for evolution, right? Where there was a successful design that can change the rate of action potentials reaching your brain, and it can be applied in different areas to give you different sensations. So that's pretty amazing. All right, so it can't be used as proof for evolution, but certainly it can be used as maybe some supporting evidence for it. Okay. All right, so I do want you to know that particular table. And all of these things work because what do the hair cells have? They have those stereocilia and the kinocilium, which bend, which can change action potentials reaching the brain. And they bend due to what? Mechanical events, changes, because sound is a physical mechanical wave that is actually moving through the air. So you need a medium like air or sound to medium like air or water to transmit sound. So if you're in outer space where there's nothing in outer space, could you hear anything in outer space? No, because there's no way for a physical wave to move through a vacuum, right? There has to be some kind of medium. Okay. All right, so let's move on to vision. All right, vision measures waves as well, but these are electromagnetic waves. So it's almost like electricity, but there's a magnetic part to it. And the whole electromagnetic spectrum goes from radio waves, and these are the lengths of the waves in terms of very, very small units of measure called angstrom units, 10 to the 14th, all the way up to very, very short waves, which we call gamma waves. And the sun puts out all of these different kinds of waves. And these, right in this region right here, which is a very narrow bandwidth of these waves, comprises the visible light spectrum. All right, so what's another not-so-fancy name for the visible light spectrum? The visible light spectrum, and you've seen this, okay? Who's been to Hawaii lately? What does it do in Hawaii? It rains when the sun is out. What do you get when the sun is out? You get a rainbow. So the visible light spectrum is really a rainbow. So if you combine all of those colors that you see right there, if they're actually all combined together, then it kind of looks white. Right, and how can you remember all the different colors in the rainbow? Right, you got this Roy G. Biv right here, somebody's fake name. R stands for red, orange, yellow. Oh, is red over there? Oh, I should write his name backwards. Okay, or flip that rainbow around. Okay, and then blue, indigo, and violet. Can you see indigo, what color indigo is? I have no idea. Okay, but that's pretty amazing that I can lecture about something that I have no idea about. All right, so this is the visible light spectrum, or a rainbow. And you can see these things with your eyes, right? All right, so let's talk about some accessory structures of the eyes. So these structures aren't directly responsible for vision, but they allow your eyes to work properly so that you can see things. And the first thing that we're going to look at is the iris. So the iris can adjust how much light enters your eye that reaches your retina, depending on whether it is dilated or contracted. Right, and there are two kinds of muscles that make up the iris. There are radial muscles that look like spokes right here, and then there are circular muscles. Right, so can you, with your conscious control, control the diameter of your pupil? So the pupil is really the hole in the iris. So the pupil is not really a structure, it's really a hole in the iris. But can you, with your consciousness, control your pupil diameter? It happens what? Automatically. All right, so what nervous system is controlling your pupil? It's your autonomic nervous system, right? So, and usually if we think of the autonomic nervous system, you've got two divisions which are antagonistic to each other, right? Okay, so you can't control your pupils directly, but light, ambient light, will control your pupil diameter. So, for instance, the radial fibers right here get stimulated, okay, and they contract. So these are smooth muscles. They contract. It pulls on these circular smooth muscles, and then your pupil dilates as a result of that, right? So this is what happens under sympathetic stimulation. So sympathetic stimulation causes the radial fibers to contract and your pupils dilate. Now, on the other hand, when the light is very, very bright, guess what happens? Your pupils constrict. So the stimulation of the sympathetic fibers right here decreases, and what increases? The parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so here we can see this is a nice autonomic pathway because I see the preganglionic fiber, postganglionic fiber. This comes from the oculomotor nerve. You've probably heard of that. That's a cranial nerve, right? What is that? Number 3, all right? So, okay, then that stimulates these radial fibers right here, and when they contract, your pupil constricts. And that just protects the retina from excessive light. All right, so that's just the balance of the sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation. There is another accessory structure that allows your eye to function properly, and that is the lens right here. So the job of the lens is to focus light on the retina. Right? So even a camera has a lens. So that pictures look what? Nice and sharp. Yeah, nice and sharp. And if light isn't focused, then they look blurry, and you don't want to look around and see blurry things. You'd like to have things nice and sharp. All right, so the lens has a certain shape to bend light so that it focuses on the retina. All right, but there's something else that's really important and even more important for focusing light on the retina than the lens. Do you see something else that is curved, that has curvature? And it actually kind of looks like a lens, and that is the cornea right here. All right, so the cornea is just a static structure. It can't change its shape. It can't change its curvature. But you know what? When you look at something, sometimes you look at something that's close to you, and then other times you look at something that's far away. And you actually need different curvature to focus light when it's close to you compared to when it's far away. And so the structure in your eye that actually changes its curvature so that you can see things close up or far away, but not at the same time, is called the lens. And the process of changing the shape of the lens so that it gets more curved or less curved so that you can look at things close up or far away is what we call accommodation. Right, so the lens is important for accommodation. You could do a little experiment really quick. Maybe you did it in lab, right? Did you like put your hand in front of you like this and then focus on your thumb? What does everything way behind your thumb look like when you're focusing on your thumb? It's blurry. And then when you look in the distance past your thumb, what does your thumb look like? It's blurry, right? So you can't focus on everything at one time. You have to pick what distance you're going to be focusing on. And that's the job of accommodation to allow that to happen. So accommodation is due to a muscle right here that can apply tension to the lens. And when it applies tension to the lens gets thinner and is not so curved. Right? This muscle right here is called the ciliary muscle. And it's connected to the lens via these ligaments that we call suspensory ligaments. All right? When And this is a little bit strange because usually we think that when a muscle contracts, that's when it's going to be applying tension, right? Okay, but that's if it's a linear muscle. If we have a muscle, a straight rectus muscle between two points and it contracts, what happens to those two points? They get pulled together, right? But if it's a circular muscle and it contracts, right? What happens to, say, if we had a fiber running across from one end of the circle to the other, when that circle contracts, right, what happens to tension inside the circle? It actually decreases because the points are coming closer together. That releases the tension. All right, and then when the circle expands, what happens to tension? It actually increases. So if we had a string, right, the tension of that string would actually increase. So it works a little bit different. All right, so here is the ciliary muscle, and when it's relaxed, that's when it puts tension on the suspensory ligaments, and that's when the lens gets stretched and it becomes very, very flat. All right, so that's what happens when you're looking at something that's far away. You don't need a lot of curvature. Light that's coming to you from far away is more parallel. It doesn't need to be bent as much to be focused on the retina. So that's what happens. So the ciliary muscle relaxes. That applies tension to these suspensory ligaments. Then, when you look at something close to you, right, there's more divergence in the light rays. So you need more curvature to focus on the lens. And so what happens then is that the ciliary muscle contracts. That releases tension on these suspensory ligaments. And look what happens to the lens. It gets shorter, but thicker and more curvature, so light is bent to a greater degree so that it can focus on the retina behind the eye. All right, and so that process is what we call accommodation, and that's the ciliary muscle is important for that and the lens, but the cornea does not change shape. Astigmatisms come into play because of the shape of the lens. All right, so if we look at the lens right here in terms of astigmatism, and we have another graph, but maybe I could talk a little bit about it right now. Right now, if we were to cut this lens in half, right, and then flop it over so that this bottom point is superimposed with this top point right here, notice it would match up pretty exactly, right? That's really symmetrical about this axis right here. Do you see the shape of the lower half of the lens really matches the shape of the upper half so that if you were to fold it over, they would match up exactly, okay? If somebody has astigmatism, it means that maybe the lens on the top part is a lot thinner in this region compared to the thickness of it down over here. So it doesn't have a nice symmetrical shape anymore. So it doesn't focus symmetrically depending on where the light rays are coming in. The top might not focus as much as the bottom part over here. So somebody with an astigmatism can see things that are in focus, but not their whole visual field. They'll see part in focus, but another part maybe on the top or off to an angle will be out of focus because the lens is not symmetrical if you were to make a cut through it. Okay, that's what produces an astigmatism. And that can be corrected by using a non-symmetrical kind of lens. And maybe I have that on the next slide. I don't know. I have it someplace close right here. Oh, yeah. Here we go. Okay. So visual acuity is just the sharpness of vision. Oh, but you know what? I do want to go back to this slide just for a second. Guess what happens as you get older? Okay. This lens, like many other things in your body, gets stiffer. Right? It doesn't like to change shape quite as much. Right, it also loses transparency. It can become opaque, and that's what we would call a cataract. Right, but that's a different kind of thing that just makes everything look really, really gray. But as you get older, the lens gets stiffer, so it's harder to change shape, and it's harder to accommodate. And it takes longer because the ciliary muscle also takes longer to operate. Right, so I kind of use that as an example of when you see somebody driving maybe 40 miles an hour down the 405 freeway, okay, what could you tell me about that person? Probably they're elderly, right? Because they just can't see quite as well. And accommodation is the really big thing for them. Because what is somebody who's maybe 70 or 75 years old, what are they afraid of when they're driving the most? Yeah, maybe crashing, but even without crashing, they don't want to get a ticket, like a speeding ticket, right? Because then they got to go to DMV and do all kinds of driver tests, and they'll probably get their license removed from them, and they'll lose a lot of independence when that happens. So they certainly don't ever want to speed, right? So where do you look to find if you're speeding or not? Close up, the speedometer, right? So you look at the speedometer, so you got to accommodate to see the speedometer. But if you're looking at the speedometer, what could you do? Somebody said it already. You could crash into something, right? So you look up from the speedometer, right, down the road to see you're not going to crash into anything. And, of course, you don't want to miss your exit because the last place you want to be at that age is driving down the 405, right? So you look down the windshield, and what do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry because you have to accommodate. And as you're older, right, it takes longer. So 1001, 1002, 1003, things pop into focus. And you go, all right, there's my exit. I haven't passed it yet. You're relieved. And then what's the next thought? A wave of anxiety again, because what are you worried about? You haven't missed your exit, but you don't want to speed, right? So you look back down at the speedometer, and what do you see? Nothing. It's a blur because you haven't accommodated yet. So you look at the speedometer, and it goes, what, 1001, 1002, and then it pops into focus. And then you're relieved. You're not speeding. But now what do you do? What are you worried about? Your exit. You don't want to miss your exit. So you look out the windshield, and what do you see? Nothing, right? It's just a blur until you accommodate once again. So what's important for accommodation? It's the lens and ciliary muscle. All right, so, you know, I always say, when you see those viejitos out there, just be really kind to them because they just can't see as well as us younger people, right? So just stay away from them, be polite, don't hassle them because they just need more time to make the correct decisions because of accommodation, yeah.
When you have that aura, like when you get a migraine,
oh, okay. I'm not a super specialist on that, but that is actually affecting the primary visual cortex or association areas in the visual centers of the occipital lobe. So it's more a cranial event than it is a retinal event or an optic nerve. Nope, it shouldn't. But you could have problems with rods and cones. You could have problems on the optic nerve, so which could also cause headaches. So if you have migraine headaches, it's really good to talk with somebody that could actually find out what is happening right there. Because there are tumors that can develop on the optic nerve. All right, but usually migraines are due to intracranial events, okay, inside the brain. And those respond really well to some really nice miracle drugs, you know, like Maxalt, and there's a couple of others, okay, that can take a migraine headache away like that.
But what I'm asking is, why does it, you know how it gives you that aura sense in your vision?
Yeah.
How does it affect?
There are just depolarizations in neurons that spread. Okay, so certain neurons that shouldn't be stimulating each other without proper sensory input, right, start to stimulate each other, and it could be due to maybe depression of inhibitory pathways or excitation of excitatory pathways that produce that. And you can have that aura without the painful migraine headache, right? So that's what you call a migraine equivalent episode. So that can disrupt your vision. You can't see very well, but it's not followed with a true migraine headache, which is fortunate. Yeah, that's the visual cortex. I think that's mostly brought on, at least in people of our age group that haven't experienced head trauma. I think that's just really due to an overdose of caffeine and maybe some other drugs if you're taking. So if you have a lot of aura, cut back on the caffeine a little bit and see if that helps. Yeah.
How about blind spots? When I used to get migraines, they used to get blind spots everywhere. They would actually come before the migraines.
Interesting. Okay. I would say that's an intracranial event. That's something that's happening with the cells in the occipital lobe, okay, but not the retina, not the optic nerve. But if it's a routine thing, you probably need to get that diagnosed exactly to see what's happening. Okay. Oh, that's really nice. Yeah. There's another question. Okay, when the circular muscle, the ciliary muscle.
Okay.
No, it just changes the focus. So adjusting the iris is independent of accommodation. So those two processes happen pretty much independently of each other. Yeah. Oh, you have trouble seeing?
No, I'm just asking.
Oh.
So if there's more light, does my lens, does it contract? Does it feel like it contracts?
No, think of only the iris contracting. Yeah, the iris contracts. And in particular, the circular muscles of the iris. So the circular muscle of the iris is different than the circular muscle ciliary body. They're both circular, smooth muscles, but they're different. Okay? Yeah. Okay. All right, so that's accommodation. Don't forget accommodation. Also, sharpness of vision depends on how the lens interacts with the cornea. So don't forget the cornea acts as a very powerful lens. Actually, it's more powerful than the lens itself. The lens, though, allows you to accommodate, to make for fine adjustments where you're looking. All right, and if it just so happens that the curvature of your cornea and the curvature of the lens is matched properly, you see a nice clear image because light rays are focused on the retina. All right, so we call that normal vision or emmetropia. Maybe you've talked about this in lab already. All right, so if light is being focused right on the retina, and maybe you can remember where the retina is from anatomy, right? That's the deepest layer of the eye, right up over here. Then you have nice sharp vision, no correction is necessary. But if for whatever reason your eyeball itself is a little short, right? If it's not long enough, and let's keep the cornea and the lens the same, then light is going to focus behind it. So what you see are light rays that are divergent or non-focus, and you'll have blurry vision. All right, so we call this farsightedness, when the light is focusing behind the eyeball. And we call that hyperopia. And to correct for that, you need a lens, which is convex, so it starts to bend the light sooner before it even reaches the eye, so that by the time light reaches the retina, it is now clearly in focus. So hyperopia needs to be corrected with a convex lens. But you might actually have an eye that's a little bit long, right? And that's just determined by, what, the shape of the sclera, the shape of the orbital cavity, and, right, so that's just something you're kind of born with. So if your eyeball is way too long, then the light is going to focus in front of the retina. We call that myopia, right, or nearsightedness. And to correct for that, we don't want to use a convex lens. We need to use a concave lens. All right, so this spreads the light out a little bit before it reaches the eye. So now it gets focused at a little bit more distant location compared to the lens. So now it focuses on the retina. So these vision abnormalities can be corrected pretty easily with lenses, as can astigmatism. All right, so this is not a really good picture of astigmatism because if we were going to draw the lens, what would the lens be like? But it could be the cornea as well. So the lens, typically in a normal eye, is what? Nice and symmetrical like that. But for instance, if somebody with an astigmatism, all right, and if we draw the same over here, now the lens might be getting a little bit thinner in one location. So it's not the same thickness compared to the bottom part. Right, so the light isn't going to be bent the same degree up over here compared to down over in this region. So in order to correct for that, we need a lens that is asymmetrical. So it bends light in different degrees, okay, let's just say from right to left. And so now the whole visual field will focus on the retina properly with astigmatism. Yeah, you just add them together, blink and blink. Yeah, you just add them together. But you can't correct farsightedness and nearsightedness together. Okay, but astigmatism you can. Right, which is something sort of interesting. There's a relatively new procedure, well, it was new to me not too many years ago, where you could actually change the shape of the cornea to improve your vision. And it's really kind of a handy technique, right, because the lens and the shape of the cornea work together so that you can see things clearly in focus, right? And it's called the LASIK procedure. And the LASIK procedure is a laser procedure where a physician can blast away a couple cell layers of the cornea right here, change the shape of the cornea so that you don't have to wear glasses. Okay, but the LASIK procedure, just like these lenses, can only change what? Can only change farsightedness or nearsightedness, but not both together. And as a matter of fact, if you put on glasses so that you can see far away, the trade-off is that you lose your near vision. All right, that's why a lot of people, when they have glasses like I do for seeing far away, but want to read something, what do we have to do? We've got to take them off because they work against each other. And the same thing for a LASIK procedure, right? The LASIK procedure is working just like a pair of glasses. When you have a LASIK procedure and you can now see things very clearly far away, guess what you're giving up? Your near vision, just because of the physics of the way the eye works. And I have had a lot of friends really upset with that LASIK procedure because the physician didn't tell them that, right? They were amazed because as soon as they got the LASIK procedure, they had perfect vision, and then walk outside, got a call on their cell phone, got their cell phone out, and tried to make a call or answer the call, and they couldn't see the cell phone without reading glasses. All right, so they traded faraway glasses for the necessity now for having to have reading glasses so that they can read, work on the computer, or make a cell phone call. Okay, so there's no procedure where you can correct both at the same time. But some people actually can correct one eye for far away and the other for close up and be just fine. But I haven't known anybody. But people tell me there are people that are like that all the time. Has anybody ever corrected their eyes that way, for one eye for far away and one eye for close up, and live a normal life? Okay. I've talked to a lot of people that tried it, but they just couldn't get used to it. Okay. So there are other problems with that LASIK procedure. It can go wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So I only really recommend it for medical reasons, not for cosmetic reasons. For instance, if your vision is so poor you can't even find your glasses in the morning, then the LASIK procedure is fantastic, right? It will change your life. But if you're just doing it because you don't like glasses, it's probably not a really good reason because of the trade-off involved. And the other thing is, when you get your eyes corrected, even with lenses, does your prescription for your lenses last your whole lifetime? No, because as we get older, our face changes and our vision changes. It could get better or it could get worse, but it's probably going to change. And just like glasses, LASIK will only correct your vision for that one point in time. All right, so it's not something that will last forever. So if you do get that LASIK procedure, make sure you talk to a good, reputable physician that will tell you all this stuff ahead of time before you do it. But, all right, so you know what? We didn't finish up today. So next time we got to start talking about the retina. You might want to read over this in the book because it's a little freaky how it works. The basic principles of depolarization, which is stimulatory work, but the system is a little funny. So if you can read it before the lecture, that will help you out. And look over the slides a little bit. Yeah, let me try it right here, right now.